In 2011, members of the sleepy little town of Mount Pleasant, Utah were growing concerned. They had seen large fields once used for farming seemingly taken up with men in camo and guns. Each week, onlookers would spot groups of men running drills, looking like they were preparing for the end of days. This group ended up being a local militia, largely organized by a Mormon fundamentalist sect known as the AUB.
You can look this up. There's a great article by Nate Carlisle in the Salt Lake Tribune that talks about this little militia from the Apostolic United Brethren. It's a polygamous breakoff sect, which I've covered a ton about in Year of Polygamy. And it talks about one of their local militias that they were running during the presidency of Obama. Let me just give you a Mormon militia 101. Basically, anytime a Democrat is elected into office, Mormon fundamentalists, Mormons, conservatives, constitutionalists, and libertarians lose their minds. Put someone like Obama in, who was the first black president, and a Democrat, we're talking apocalypse. So, of course, you can read about this militia, but it's crazy. Basically, they're tucked up in the sheep fields of Mount Pleasant, running drills. They end up putting explosives or plan to put explosives in both sides of the mountain. So when all the world goes to hell and the government comes to take your guns, they can really blow it up. Eventually get shut down. Even the AUB has to distance themselves from it. It's a crazy story. Why are these men in these sleepy farming communities running drills and starting militias? Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
I had lunch last week with my good buddy, Kenneth Lines, who is also known as Mithrin on the Mormon Reddit communities. He's a really good dude. And as we sat at our annual lunch at David's Kitchen, sipping our hot and sour slowly, the conversation inevitably turned to cults. Mithrin has done a lot of writing about dynamics of cultic systems, and so we were sort of sharing our own experiences working with different communities that people sometimes feel were cultish. You know, like hippie communities, wild, wild country stuff. Those sorts of things. We follow all the cult shows. I'm helping co-produce some work for the new cult podcast that Ty Meesom is putting out for iHeartRadio. Cults come up every once in a while. And to me, I think the common component of cults is the idea of some communal work to change the world for the better. So you usually see this, all cults have this idea that they're going to change the world somehow, and it has to be done in community, which in and of itself is not a bad idea. It just seems that all cults that I have followed have a similar pattern, this idea of building a utopian community that involves communal living and plan to change the world. So I'm waxing off about this during lunch, and Mithrin cuts in. He says, don't forget secret police. If you're a cult, you need to have a secret police. Now, before you turn the podcast off because we use the C word, hang on just a minute. I know the word cult is extremely fraught in Mormonism, but with my work dealing with many, many Mormon groups, it's hard to deny that at least some of the Mormon groups we know of, like the FLDS, for example, are cults, if not cultish.
Well, this might be a good time to talk about a random trip we just went on with some friends recently. As you may or may not know, the FLDS had several places of refuge stocked way around the country. You've undoubtedly heard about Texas, the most famous of them, but there were others. There was one in Colorado, and there was one in South Dakota, actually not too far from Mount Rushmore. You may also have heard that recently the property up there was sold at a sheriff's sale to former members of the FLDS Church, who we know. And they invited us to come up there and kind of check out what was there and kind of give them some ideas about what was there, what they had on their hands. And so we, some of us got there a little earlier than others.
Some of us missed our flight.
Pro tip, bring your wallet if you want to get on a plane. Just one for the kids. But we got to see what happens when an apocalyptic community essentially gets raptured.
That's exactly what it felt like. We got unique access to basically an FLDS compound before anyone else got to see it. It's still a controversial move within the FLDS community. Some people think that the seizure shouldn't happen. Some people think it should. We just got to go see the documents to tell people what they had. This is worth saving. This is not worth saving. This is worth keeping. And it was quite the Indiana Jones foray into one of the most devastating, oppressive places I've ever been. It was a end of days bunker that the FLDS had planned. The end of the world was in 2013. When it didn't happen, they abandoned this. We're talking large warehouses of food, large that are just left there to rot since 2013.
Supplies just in case there's no electricity.
Two fonts, by the way. And can we talk about this? Why, when Jesus comes, why is there not going to be electricity?
I have to think that it's part of the larger kind of prepper vibe that somehow is part of the end of days stuff that the electrical grid just dies. I mean, you know, whether that sometimes that's an electromagnetic pulse that just kills it. I mean, there's all sorts of explanations, but that is a very common thing, which I do think is a little odd.
What was fun is they found Warren's secret vault in a hidden door full of documents, which we got to go through. And hopefully we'll be able to talk about that soon. We can't really talk about that publicly too much right now, but we went through lots of documents. It was exciting finding new documents, but it was also really depressing seeing two baptismal fonts, all these clothes, all these things. And I bring this up to say, to understand the topic that we're going to talk about today, the Nauvoo Legion, I think you really need to allow yourself to explore the C word. Put yourself in two different headspaces today. And I want to remind people that Mormonism doesn't just belong to the LDS Church. It's a larger movement and affects a larger history of people, including thousands and thousands of people like the FLDS who grew up in what many think is a cult. So today, I'm going to invite you to put your headspace first with the Mormons who were building Nauvoo. They were borrowing ideas from Kirtland, from the Kirtland days and elsewhere. And by the time Mormons were in Nauvoo, they were really trying to establish this beautiful communal system. They had this grand idea of building Zion, a utopian society that would help usher in the second coming of Jesus. But of course, like my friend Kenneth Lyons said, every utopian society finds itself in need of a secret police.
And think about it for a minute, because the other perspective you got to have is that of the people on the outside watching the Mormons. And it's one thing to be a Mormon in Nauvoo, believing Jesus will be coming, and wanting to live your sacred doctrines the way you believe God wants. It's an entirely different issue to be living in Illinois and watching as what you believe are religious zealots are buying up all the property, voting in block, electing the people they want, and basically taking over the city. Hide your wives, hide your kids.
And this is why I bring the C word into existence, because it's taken me a very long time as a Mormon girl to try and understand the other side of Mormon persecution. For many years of my life, I was taught a fairly singular narrative about how our ancestors were these sweet, pious pilgrims who were severely persecuted for their beliefs. But the other side of it was startling to see, and you can see it when you go to a compound like in South Dakota. We're sort of, as Mormon historians, outsiders and insiders to this. So as an outsider, we're like, this is horrific. I can't believe these people believe this. But on the other side, they're feeling driven from their places and their homes.
I know why they believe this.
Yes, exactly. So it's just, this is the invitation that we're giving. We want you to see both sides. Because the folks in and around Illinois saw the Mormons like we see Scientologists or the folks in Wild Wild Country or how people see the FLDS. Sure, They are religious hippies with a grander ideal. But they're also acquiring a lot of guns and ammo. They seem to, you know, these Mormons in Nauvoo, they seem to be acquiring more and more every day. It's startling to think about watching a group who claim that they are there to bring in Jesus stockpiling, I don't know, so many guns. It's all peace, love, and Jesus until the military and secret police show up.
Which brings us to the Nauvoo Legion. Today, as we talk about this history of the organization, how it came to be, what it did, how it affected Mormonism, we want to give you a typical Sunstone invitation. Try to look at this story from several perspectives. If you've been a Mormon your entire life, think about how these events would have read to an outsider. If you are an outsider and always thought Mormons were inching closer to the C word, perhaps consider why the Nauvoo Legion was important from the Mormon perspective.
Hang down your head now, what have you done? Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head now, what have you done? It's time to say goodbye. Hang down your head now, what have you done?
When the Saints arrived in Nauvoo, it had been quite the couple of years. Mobs, persecution, an extermination order from the state of Missouri. It was a violent time, and we've covered a lot of that here in the podcast. Before making it to Illinois, Mormons had already experimented with ways to protect their group. So, for example, from May to June of 1834 in Kirtland, Joseph Smith led an expedition of Latter-day Saints known as Zion's Camp. This is considered by most Joseph's first attempt at militia organizing with his group known as the, quote, Armies of Israel. And according to Will Bagley, Smith also organized all adult Mormon males in Missouri into a private army known as the Host of Israel. So he tried a few ways of experimenting with militia, secret police, and protection. When the Mormons arrive in Commerce, Illinois, those tensions that existed in Missouri were even more amplified. Mormons were largely driven out by Missouri mobs through violence and a lot of conflict and pain. They, just like our FLDS friends being driven from their compounds, Mormons felt really persecuted. And there was good reason for that. After Governor Boggs issued an extermination order against the Mormons, little settlements of Mormons from all over the country started paying the price. People were attacked, driven from their homes, and a swampy settlement across the river looked like refuge. So they decided to start a city, not just to build the kingdom of God for Jesus' return, but also to live in peace. And to start a city, you need a charter.
It's really important to understand what a charter even is and why it keeps coming up when we talk about Nauvoo. When a piece of land and its occupants fall in love, they give each other a special hug, commonly called a charter, and a city is born. Don't tell me the kids at recess haven't talked about this. So to become a city, especially in this period of history, if you're going to gather together in a certain place, and then you want the larger rights and protections that exist for surrounding cities and townships, you have to have a charter to get organized. It's really kind of a very European way of organizing that finds its roots in the feudal system. If you wanted protection from the crown, from, you know, marauding tribes and bands of thieves, you had to swear an oath of fealty to your king. In the Mormons' case, if you want to settle on previously occupied Indian lands that were taken from the U.S. government, pull out a charter.
When Mormons arrived in Illinois at the beginning of 1839, they realized pretty quickly that organizing a city would help them not only to avoid some of the conflicts that they had experienced in Missouri, like being removed from their land, but it would also let them consolidate their power and better protect themselves. A charter would also allow for Mormons to enact habeas corpus, which meant if you were arrested or detained by someone, the judge could demand to see that person being held in custody, so you couldn't just kidnap them forever and say you had them. Turns out, this ends up being a very important thing for Joseph Smith because it keeps happening to him. People would be upset, detain or arrest him, and then the Mormons would demand to know he was okay.
See, knowing Latin can help you out sometimes. The charter that they developed allowed for all sorts of things, organizing this legal system with very helpful powers, getting resources to people, rules about being good neighbors, keeping the city clean. The Joseph Smith Papers Project folks said it best, quote, "Under the act incorporating the city of Nauvoo, Illinois, passed by the Illinois legislature in December 1840, the city could operate a municipal court with power to grant writs of habeas corpus in all cases arising under the ordinances of the city council. This provision was apparently intended to limit the court's jurisdiction to prisoners who were detained for alleged violations of city ordinances. However, the The Nauvoo Charter authorized the Nauvoo City Council to pass any ordinance necessary for the peace, benefit, good order, regulation, convenience, and cleanliness of the city, as long as it was not repugnant to the national or state constitutions. Under this provision, on July 5, 1842, the City Council passed an ordinance that provided that no citizen of this city shall be taken out of the city by any writs without the privilege of investigation before the municipal court on a writ of habeas corpus. By implication, the ordinance expanded the municipal court's authority to issue habeas corpus for any writs or arrest warrants, whether issued by federal, state, or city officials.
The Nauvoo Charter also called for the formation of a militia, which was appropriately called the Nauvoo Legion. Under Illinois law, you could organize a militia. Basically, the state said, okay, we understand we are new and growing territory and we can't protect you from Indians, from conflict, or help enact justice. You need to do it yourself. So you can organize a little army known as a militia, but it still has to be under the control of the government at the end of the day. The Legion could be called on at any time to be used by the state governor or even the president of the United States. But what really matters for the purposes of our story is that the Legion could also be called upon at the disposal of the Nauvoo mayor, who just so happens to be Joseph Smith.
And you don't actually have to take our word for it. Lindsay finally sat down with Nauvoo expert and historian of early America, Ben Park, to talk about what the Nauvoo Legion actually was.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me. Well, it's good enough for my grandpa, it was good enough. For my grandpa, that was good enough. For my grandpa, that's good enough for me.
I'm bringing on Professor Ben Park. We talk a lot about you on the show, and it just felt wrong to talk about you and to not talk with you. So, hi, Ben. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Reports of my troublemaking have been greatly exaggerated.
I hope that we can continue to create false myths and rumors about you. Our history is solid, but our stories about Ben Park might not be. You'll have to decide.
It's an honor to be on, Lindsay.
It's so, we've known each other for so long, and everyone thinks we're related or married, or the weird one is brother and sister, which I guess maybe we could both be sealed under. We would have to agree on the same apostle. Who would we be sealed under? Who can we agree on?
I think we have to go someone outside the mainstream, like Joseph Merrill or something, that like to where it's just so random, it's hard to disabuse.
Well, I was going to say a Tanner, but they run into trouble. I don't know. Let's think about that. We will. Right. We're going to link our eternal family somehow, but it won't be through any of those reasons. It will be through an anonymous Mormon man who wore
a mask to hide their identity, like they did back in the post-manifesto days.
Yeah, now we're getting, I mean, now it's starting to sound like Joseph Musser. So, okay. Yes. Why don't we talk about your background? It's weird that we haven't brought you on. It's only out of sheer laziness on my part that we haven't brought on a lot of guests for Nauvoo, but there's a lot to talk about, especially with your book. In fact, I was just asked to review your book for our MHA this year. So
ooh, I hope you're kind.
I wasn't planning on it. I was full of innuendo and really mean jokes.
Well, if you want to see all the salacious details, you have to register for MHA second weekend of June in Park City.
That's right. And I'm going to be pulling out all the gossip about Ben. I attacked his character. I attack his cooking. I attack his relationship with Desnat, his purported relationship with Desnat. So tell us about the book. Why did you write about Nauvoo? Like, of all the things, why that?
Well, I've always been a Nauvoophile. Nauvooian is, I think, how they term it. When I returned from my LDS mission, I needed a stepping stone back into the real world. And back then, BYU had a semester away program at Nauvoo. So I ended up spending 4 months in Nauvoo and quickly fell in love with the city, fell in love with the history, changed my major from pre-med to history. And then I never looked back, except I, you know, went on and did lots of work outside of Mormonism. My first book doesn't mention Mormonism at all. And then when the church released the Council of 50 records in 2016, and I looked at them, I realized, oh my goodness, there's a book here. And I put off what I was supposed to be writing, and I wrote about that. And the result was my book, Kingdom of Nauvoo.
So when you were in Nauvoo hanging out, did you ever do a historical tour with Susan Easton Black?
I did later. That's the really funny thing is I co-led a tour of Nauvoo with Susan Easton Black.
Oh, you did?
I really did.
Why didn't she say that in her critique of...
Because I'm so unmemorable that she didn't remember it.
Well, I think she needs to issue a correction because... You did. What we're talking about is Susan Easton Black wrote a review.
Yes, she wrote a review for The Interpreter.
And she said one of her critiques was that you didn't tell a faithful perspective of the prophets, and partially because you didn't attend her faith-promoting tour. And I feel like now we know that you did, and you still didn't write about the glories of the prophet. Why didn't you do that, Ben?
You know what? Very few people can be Susan Easton Black. And once I realized that I was not going to make that standard, I decided I had to carve my own path.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it's interesting to hear that critique from historians, like respected historians like Susan Easton Black, because I think Mormons are still grappling with how to hear their own history and not have it be faith promoting, just hear it, you know, sort of, and that's what we've been trying to do at Sunstone is a dispassionate discussion of all Mormon issues. And people are like, what? You can't do that. You can.
When you look at it from the history perspective, it makes sense, right? Because up until 1971, the church historian for 50 years was Joseph Fielding Smith. And Joseph Fielding Smith was raised being told stories by his father, Joseph F. Smith, about his grandfather being killed in Carthage jail. Right. And that guy was our church historian until 1971, where the history was a life or death, us versus them history. So, of course, history is going to have stakes and there's going to be a legacy that comes from that of how we talk about our history. So I don't blame people who, you know, try to hold on to these faithful narratives that do as much to build their faith as understand the past, because those narratives have been so crucial to the LDS tradition. It's just, you know, writing a book for a general public, which is what I try to do with Kingdom of Nauvoo. There's another set of standards and judgments that you have to make.
Well, and this is why you are who you are and I am who I am, because I'm like, oh, you know, you're not taking it far enough. I don't think it's okay that we hold on to those narratives, because what you're doing is you're building, to use a primary song, your house out of sand. We're building our reasons and our faith on someone else's story, someone else's reasons for developing a narrative like that. And I don't know, I guess it's because I feel so connected to Mormonism still. One of the reasons why I, you know, get frustrated and, you know, don't attend my local ward is because people can't put on their big kid pants and have conversations about what really happened. That's all I need. That's all I need for my Mormon community. And so I'm trying to foster that here. Like, to me, I'm not someone who put all of my faith on these pioneer stories. I put a lot of faith onto them. And all I've done is just shift and repurpose it. When new information came, I'm like, oh, okay, it's still important to me, but now I've got new information. So anyway, sorry to preach. Your book is excellent. I think it's probably kind of groundbreaking in the sense that, yeah, you're showing people, you can talk about this history that means so much to people and just talk about it without engaging in mythos, right? Let people build whatever myths they want. You're just going to tell us the facts in a very, might I say, interesting way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's about the best compliment I can get. And I should say I receive emails every week from people who read the book and have the same perspective. I receive emails from people who don't feel the same way about the book too, but I tend to mostly ignore them. But I've been very happy with the reception of the book and engagement from people who are willing to investigate the past in more rigorous ways.
Yeah. And I think, again, there's theology and Joseph Smith's writings for people that want to feel inspired by him as, you know, as a prophet figure. But history does a different job. And Mormonism has a really interesting relationship with telling history in a way that, I mean, all things are supposed to build up the kingdom of God, right? But history does if we just let it be as honest as possible, I think. So kudos. Let's talk about Nauvoo.
Do it.
I want you to tell us the story of the Nauvoo Legion. There's a lot we could have you talk about, but today I want you to tell us about the Nauvoo Legion. Who are they? What are they doing? Where did they come from? Why are they important?
The true origins of the Nauvoo Legion are in Missouri, because after the Mormon-Missouri War in 1838, the Joseph Smith and the Saints realized that there was something that had to be done to make sure that what happened in Missouri did not take place again. Because in their mind, what took place in Missouri was a state-sanctioned mob evicting them from their property. And so they no longer had trust in, you know, typical mechanisms for defense and support and retribution. And so if the state is not, cannot be relied upon, they're going to have to rely on themselves. And so the Nauvoo Legion was envisioned as a last ditch effort to protect them in ways that they were not protected in Missouri. And so in late 1840 and early 1841, when they're pushing for the new Nauvoo Charter, which is the organizing document from the state of Illinois that incorporates Nauvoo as a city, one of their major provisions was that they could raise a large legion that is at the city's directive, most importantly, at Joseph Smith's directive as a lieutenant general. By the way, Joseph Smith, the first man in America to hold the title lieutenant general since George Washington, to give you a sense of how highly they saw the prophet back then. Now, this Nauvoo Legion was theoretically a part of the state militia, because there were state militias, and there would be local branches, local divisions, units of that militia, and Nauvoo was going to be part of that. So, for instance, if you were to serve in the Nauvoo Legion, that would exempt you from serving in the state legion. But the fact that they were going to be given marching orders from the city rather than the state was pretty radical. One of the reasons they're able to get that through is that John C. Bennett was the one doing these negotiations. And John C. Bennett was, I forget his exact title, but something like the Brigadier General of the state militia.
Quartermaster.
Yeah, quartermaster. He was in charge of the supplies, of the ammunition, of the guns. And so you could see how some state politicians and military people would be like, well, okay, so this Nauvoo thing isn't going to be that bad, because look at who's in charge. Someone we trust, John C. Bennett, someone who theoretically works for the state militia. So, of course, they're not going to, you know, go too far afield from what the state militia wants. The state is also willing to push forward the Nauvoo Charter for other reasons, because they're currying favor with the Saints. Both political parties, Illinois is almost evenly politically divided at the time between the Whigs and the Democrats. And so both political sides are tripping over each other, trying to appease the Saints, because they realize with these thousands of Saints coming in at the same time that they're getting new congressional seats, if we can court these Mormon votes, we might get control once and for all in the state. And so Nauvoo gets a very expansive provisions in the Nauvoo Charter, with the Nauvoo Legion being one of them.
Let me ask you this question, because in the podcast to Christopher Smith's horror, and maybe we'll have to make up for this later on, we sort of skipped over the Missouri period. Do you think that this idea that the Saints need protection, need this charter, need this power to sort of redress the wrongs that happened in Missouri, do you think that there's a legitimate critique there? I've heard both sides. You know, there's a lot of people that say Mormons were giving as good as they get, sometimes worse. In your opinion, was there a need for something like the Nauvoo Legion?
My perspective is, and you can kind of see this framing in the book, is I sympathize with the Mormons' critiques and anxieties in Nauvoo, especially over what happened in Missouri. Their solutions to those problems is where they get into trouble, which is why I frame my story of Nauvoo as a story of democracy's failure. As an example of what happens on the frontier when a majoritarian culture can push and pull those at the margins of society, and the margins of society have nowhere to turn. I mean, you think about when Joseph Smith goes to the federal government and appeals for redress, and national politicians say, what you're talking about is a state issue. You need to be appealing for redress from the state, not the federal government. And Joseph Smith was able to respond, I think, to a degree, quite convincingly, well, what happens when the governor is the head of the mob? How am I supposed to get redressed then? Now, today in America, we see the federal government as the final arbiter to preserve our rights that are, you know, preserved in the amendments and in the Constitution. That was not the view before the Civil War. Before the Civil War, that was a state matter. It took the Civil War and the abolitionist movement to, you know, make the federal government the final arbiter of the rights. That's what the 14th Amendment did. And so I think with the Mormons, what happened in Missouri, and they were definitely to blame for a lot of the problems there. I'm not lessening that at all. But what I think we can see is when we get a conflict like what took place in Missouri, where there's blame on both sides, both on the saints and the state, there was also a failure of a law of, you know, a dispassionate external umpire like the federal government who would have been able to save them. And when they escape Missouri or when they're evicted from Missouri and they make it in Illinois and they're trying to come up with provisions to protect themselves, and they're now, and the federal government is making it clear that they are not going to step in and save them, they're going to look for whatever provisions they can, which is where the Nauvoo Legion comes in.
Okay, that's a great answer. And I actually do think, I was thinking as you're talking, yeah, it's so hard because we're dealing with an America that isn't recognizable to us today, right? I think, especially me, as I've gone through this journey down history, to realize like my understandings of laws and protections and rights and statehood is so different than it was when Joseph Smith was organizing a church. I mean, it was really literally on the edge of the frontier, and things weren't around that we have now.
Yeah, I think that's really important to notice. And one of the reasons why I find the Nauvoo story so important to us is because living in 2021, as raucous and discordant as our political system is today, we still take democracy for granted to a large extent, that democracy is still, you know, the successful form of government and the solutions to our problems is through more democracy. Democracy was far from a sure thing in early America. It's only 50 years old by the time that the saints settle Nauvoo. It's still an experiment. And so, and that's why the Mormons in Nauvoo, especially by the end of the Nauvoo period, they saw Nauvoo as democracy as an experiment that had run its course and had proven to fail.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And that's what I think is so interesting about this idea of Mormonism as a theocracy, because it's this weird mix. Even then, you know, I was reading about the Nauvoo Legion, people's rhetoric about it, even from the time that they're talking about it in Nauvoo contemporarily to when they're in Utah reflecting on it, the language changes. It becomes more patriotic as they do. It's just, you know, their understanding of what the Nauvoo Legion was even shifts over time. And so, yeah, I think your book does a good job at contextualizing this larger, it's almost as if you're like an American historian.
You know what? I try my best anyway, Lindsay.
So talk to me. So they organized this. We know why they did. Let's talk about what it was. Tell me what it was. You know, we're going to be covering some of this, the drills that they were running, some of the things that they were doing. But explain to us the makeup of the Nauvoo Legion.
So it's important to note when talking about what it was that we compare it to what the state expected it would be. When the state approved of what was going to be the Nauvoo Legion, they expected it to function like most legions in America at the time, which meant that it would be a group of people who could marshal up to the support whenever they need it. Now, Illinois was well familiar with violence and bloodshed. They had, just the previous decade, they had what was called the Black Hawk War in Illinois, where they were fighting a number of indigenous communities over territorial rights. And Nauvoo, for instance, the area around Nauvoo was part of the spoils that they got from the battle. So these legions were expected to mostly be dormant 99% of the time. And then when they would be called to, you know, suppress dissenters or especially to evict indigenous peoples who are not fitting, then they would, you know, get their guns and wear their uniforms and go march. What Nauvoo does, though, and this is what Nauvoo does with nearly everything in the Nauvoo Charter, everything that you can find textually in the Nauvoo Charter does not seem that different or dissonant from the rest of the state, other charters that are passed. In fact, something like 95% of the Nauvoo Charter is copy and pasted from other charters that are being passed in Illinois at the time. The big significance is how the Mormons interpret the Nauvoo Charter, because they take, like, there's a phrase you know, you give them an inch and they take a mile. That's basically what the Mormons do with the Nauvoo Charter, including with the Nauvoo Legion. So instead of suddenly just being something that's going to lay dormant and only be called up when the state needs assistance, Joseph Smith has these people marching every week, doing parades, being mostly enrolled too. Very quickly, the Nauvoo Legion becomes one of the largest standing armies in the nation because they take it so much more seriously. So what was expected of the Nauvoo Legion was just basically to be a line to say, when the state needs you, be ready to grab your gun and go. But what it was very quickly a force on demand, not to the state, but to Joseph Smith.
That's so great. Yeah. One of the episodes that I'm working on for this podcast is on Jacob Hamblin. And I'm, you know, in the period where he's called to be a spy for the Nauvoo Legion, right? And it's so fascinating knowing the scope of his life and what he is going to go on to do for the church and where his journey takes him, to see him so caught up in this time period under this thing. And really, his spying didn't really result in anything but ferreting out dissenters from Mormonism. It wasn't usually outsiders coming in. It was insiders working their way out. Is that fair to say?
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
So, okay. So they're walking around doing drills, shooting their guns. Where can we talk about, do you know much about, I'm blanking on his name, William Law's brother, who was the leader of the Legion?
Wilson Law.
Can we talk about Wilson Law for a minute? Okay. So I was surprised to realize that Wilson Law, who goes on to do the Nauvoo Expositor, burns, you know, literally burns the church down, tries to, he is in charge of this Nauvoo Legion. So do you know anything about him and his role at this time?
So the Law brothers, William and Wilson Law, joined the church shortly before Nauvoo, but the first time they meet Joseph Smith is actually in Nauvoo. And Joseph Smith is very quickly impressed by those brothers. They come from respectable backgrounds. They have money. They're not coming from the poorer class like a lot of the recent converts. And so Joseph Smith very quickly puts them in places of authority. William Law as a counselor in the First Presidency, and Wilson Law as the general of the Nauvoo Legion, someone who's going to have temporal control. Now, I don't remember if Wilson Law would have had background in military. It wouldn't be far-fetched if he did, because most people did. Although William and Wilson Law arrive, Joseph Smith very quickly puts them in place of authority. William Law in the First Presidency, Wilson Law as the leader of the Nauvoo Legion. And very quickly, Wilson Law does his bidding. Wilson Law is very organized. Joseph Smith makes a number of very poor decisions in who he puts trust in, but he also succeeds in others. And the Laws are one example of that, that for several years, the Laws are able to keep Joseph Smith's visions grounded. And so Joseph Smith is very good at envisioning these grandiose plans of what the city is going to be, what the Legion is going to do. And then William Law is able to translate that into ecclesiastical structures, and Wilson Law is able to translate that into a very orderly and organized Legion.
In the business hierarchy of spiritual entrepreneurship that's going on, Wilson Law is sort of like the CFO or something. Like, he's got his specific duties. He's not over finances, but he's over military. Are they fighting anyone?
Not yet. No, they're basically there marching around. That's Joseph Smith's favorite thing, is to get them together and go out. He loves to put on a show. He had, you know, his brilliant blue coat that he would put on. He had his gorgeous horse. He would go out and march. I narrate one part in the book to where on one Saturday they march from the temple or from around where the red brick store up to the temple lot for the temple cornerstone ceremony. And then the very next Saturday, they reverse that march and they go from the temple lot down to the red brick store. And so they're mostly doing a lot of marching, but that in itself was terrifying. You can almost point to the exact moment that the Mormon problem is born in Illinois. And that's April 6th, 1841. The day that of the Nauvoo cornerstone dedication ceremony. Joseph Smith invites dignitaries from throughout the state to come witness them, both the spectacle of starting what's going to be this grandiose, marvelous building on the bluff that's going to overlook the Mississippi River, but also to show off this city that has rose up from the swamp. And one of the dignitaries that that arrives is Thomas Sharp, who is from the nearby Warsaw and edits that the newspaper down there in Warsaw. And he comes and he arrives, and the very same spectacle that Joseph Smith thought was going to impress everyone, which is this huge legion of men marching at his command, terrifies Thomas Sharp. And he goes back home and he writes a big editorial saying, I have seen the future. This is going to be the major war, a secret militia, or at least a private militia at the whim of a religious leader is an affront to democracy and a threat to our society. And so the very same thing that the Mormons saw as the bulwark of their liberty was seen as part and parcel of Mormonism's greatest threat to Illinois society.
That's fantastic. When you're talking about the marching, this is kind of a weird thing. And since we're trying to drag you into fundamentalist history, and hopefully we can, there's a lot of stories of in the FLDS community of Short Creek. It was run by a prophet before Warren Jeffs, who Uncle Leroy. Roy Johnson was the prophet, and he organized all the boys into a legion, and he would make them march and they would do drills. And so it was called Uncle Roy's Boys. And they had hats and they like started marching as a legion. And I was just like, oh, that's so interesting. Well, I've since found out that this has become an interesting thing in several of the Mormon breakoff groups. They all have some version of a legion or even a militia. The AUB was busted a couple of years ago for having a militia that they were running trainings, but they also have a secret police like the Nauvoo Legion. And we can talk about that. I just think it's interesting how Mormonism repeats itself over and over. But I can also see, if I'm a neighbor, how terrifying, you know, this, you already think it's this weird sex cult that's stealing all the women, and now they're marching with guns.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what the Mormons do is they take the greatest fears or the most ambivalent anxieties in early America, and then they put them on steroids, right? Everyone in America is terrified that religion is shaping their political system. But as long as you're part of the mainstream white evangelicals, it's fine. But Mormons take that dynamic and they, you know, take it 10 degrees further by now they have a prophet directing their political activities. At the same time, most Americans, you know, especially on the frontier, are seeking their own forms of justice, whether it be extra legal or through established systems. And then the Mormons take that and they take it to the next degree by having everyone in Nauvoo, every adult aged man was required to join the Nauvoo Legion. And
oh, I didn't know that there was a requirement.
It was a requirement, and you were fined if you were not a part of the Nauvoo Legion, and you were fined if you were not taking part of their parades.
So is that why there are non-Mormon members in it? It wasn't necessarily a spiritual thing at the time.
Yeah, I think the small number of non-Mormons who lived in Nauvoo, mostly they're merchants who are making money off of Nauvoo. They know, they can see which way the tide's going. Like they know how to play nice. So people like Hiram Kimball and others, they realize that if we're going to, you know, if I'm going to make money and stay in the city, I have to get along with Joseph Smith, which includes dressing up in funny clothes and marching on Saturday mornings with the prophet, or, you know, agreeing to donate to the Nauvoo temple. And that's why they, and I think with the Council of 50, when three non-Mormons are placed on the Council of 50 and they join, I wish we could interview those three people. I bet they mostly would answer the question of why did you join the council. They would say, I wanted to stay in Joseph Smith's good graces so I could get access to the dock work. So I think there's a lot of pragmatic reasons behind those decisions.
Okay, so that's an important thing to remember, especially that the Nauvoo Legion isn't just, I mean, it should be a political entity to begin with, but it really was one, just in ways that people don't expect. Is the Nauvoo Legion important? Is it important to the development of the church? Did it have enough of an effect that it changed history?
I think so. I mean, there's at least one major place where they saved Joseph Smith, and that was in 1843 with 1843 habeas corpus thing. The third time that Joseph Smith is arrested and about to be extradited out to Missouri, the Nauvoo Legion intercepts Joseph Smith and brings him back to Nauvoo, where the Nauvoo Municipal Court grants him a writ of habeas corpus, a long story that I don't want to bore listeners with all these Latin legal details right now. But what I find fascinating is at the moment when they, the reason they created the Nauvoo Legion, when that moment arrives in the summer of 1844, they stand down. And that's when Joseph Smith is arrested again and is going to be taken to Carthage. And one of the things that Joseph Smith has to promise or agree to when he turns himself in to Governor Thomas Ford is for the city of Nauvoo to turn over all their guns, because all their guns, or a vast majority of their guns, were issued by the state, right? And so the state at any time can, you know, request for them to be back. And there's something like 2,000 forms of weapons that we're talking about. What's fascinating is at this moment where their leader is being taken off to be jailed, Joseph Smith agrees for them to turn their guns, and all of them do it very reluctantly. We have accounts from them saying this just means we're going to be massacred as a city. And then Joseph Smith is taken to jail, and a week later when he's killed, and word is going back to Nauvoo that Joseph Smith has been killed by the mob at Carthage Jail, Governor Ford is terrified that the Nauvoo Legion is going to march on Carthage. He even demands that the city of Carthage be evacuated and all the important county records that are held at the county seat in Carthage be taken, so that when the Mormons come and burn down the city, which they thought the Nauvoo Legion was going to do, that they would be saved. So Thomas Ford requires Willard Richards, who is there in Carthage, to write a note to Nauvoo, telling them to stand down, which they do. Now, of course, there's skirmishes the next year in late summer and the fall of 1845, but it never gets to the large scale that the Mormons probably envisioned they could have done when they created the Nauvoo Legion, which is just another example where I think I highlight this a few times in my book. The Mormon rhetoric always outpaced reality in terms of their ambitions and desires of what they felt they would do to further the kingdom, and what they ended up doing when faced with new circumstances.
That, I mean, sums up of all of Mormon history, I think. And there's something like beautiful about the ambition of it, but there's also something terrifying, right? And that, I think the Nauvoo Legion is an important aspect because it highlights both of those things. Like for these people that were in it, it was such a thing of pride and a thing of brotherhood and solidarity, even into the Utah period. The Nauvoo Legion remnants remain. All the people that were in that go on to do the individual militias, for better or for worse. So yeah, I think the legacy still is around today. I mean, I grew up with a rural libertarian family, and the mindsets of what the men probably felt value in the Nauvoo Legion still exist today, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Is there anything else you want to share on the Nauvoo Legion that you think is interesting that people would want to know about?
I think we covered basically everything that I would emphasize, but I would just, you know, circle back to a point that I made before, maybe try to make it more clearly, that the Nauvoo Legion was both a embodiment of broader American tensions, that we are, that, you know, your first liberty is to protect yourself, but then an extension of it. To a degree to where it was unrecognizable to other Americans. And then it was then seen as a threat to the American system. And I think that's what the story of Nauvoo is, right? It takes a lot of these anxieties that are present in America, and it expands them to such a degree that it threatened to break the democratic system, which is why Nauvoo ended in such a mess.
That's brilliant. I love that take, because it has broader applications that I would hope people could reflect on, even if they, you know, even if they find your book challenging because it disrupts some idea that they've had about Nauvoo, those ideas are worth exploring, I think. So yeah, thanks for coming on. I want to encourage everyone to buy your book. Do you want to say anything about your book or any projects that you're working on?
Well, I'll say quickly about the book. It's going into paperback. The paperback version will be released in August. But the hardback version is still for sale now. In fact, I just saw on Amazon, it's down to $16 for a copy, which I think is quite affordable. It's always a privilege to be on the program, Lindsay.
Would you be willing to sign a few copies so we could do a giveaway?
Absolutely. That'd be wonderful.
Okay, I'll work that out with you later. And listeners, we will make sure that we do a giveaway with Ben's book. And Ben, hopefully we can have you come back because we're not done talking about Nauvoo yet.
Anytime I come on will be a privilege.
Brother Park did a great job talking about the overall history of the Legion and what and why it was for. Hopefully, that's a solid overview for you. Now, Lindsay and I will kind of zero in on some of the details about this group. Before we get into the specifics, though, like Lindsay mentioned in the interview talking about how she's seen fundamentalist groups organize similar militias, even the Nauvoo Legion had its own version of Uncle Roy's Boys. The Nauvoo Legion also had a junior subsidiary called the Nauvoo Junior Legion, also called sometimes the Sons of Helaman. Historian Glenn Leonard talks about this in his amazing article called Picturing the Nauvoo Legion. He said, quote, "These boys, known as the Sons of Helaman, paraded in colorful uniforms made by their mothers. Each boy sported white pants, a colorful blouse, and palm hat. They marched with banners and wooden guns," close quote. And somewhere, Uncle Roy is saying, "I told you so."
And really quick, Sons of Helaman is also, trigger warning, a Mormon, non-affiliated with the LDS Church support group for men recovering from pornography addiction.
And if you have "We Are As the Armies of Helaman" going through your head right now, we're not, sorry. Okay, back to Nauvoo and the Charter for a minute. The Charter was drafted in December of 1840. By the following year, the Legion was organized enough to have its first meeting in February. Babes in Toyland villain, who we can never get away from, John C. Bennett, along with Joseph's handsome younger brother, Don Carlos Smith, who were already commissioned officers of the Illinois State Militia, started to give men in Nauvoo their own commission, making them general officers in the Nauvoo Legion. The group was very militarized, organized into two cohorts or brigades. Each brigade was led by a brigadier general. And as a side note, the military terminology they used, you know, it wasn't all privates. Everybody had like 17 stars and, you know, they made a big deal that Joseph Smith was lieutenant general. He's like the only one in the country with this office. So
that's what's so fun about Glenn Leonard's article, because it's all about how they were portrayed in paintings. And so he talks about all the like minutiae of their uniforms and what they like. Apparently, unsurprising, Bennett had all kinds of fancy frills and stuff. And Joseph, his were just simple power plays, right? Anything that made him look powerful. And yeah, all the uniforms were issued by the state of Illinois, but Mormons, you know, I'm not even making this up, took out the crotch a little bit on some of them. So there were all kinds of fun things.
If you're going to, you know, play soldiers as a grown-up, make it worth your while, I guess. So the first brigade was cavalry, and the second cohort was made up of artillery and infantry troops. Some people have estimated the Legion was once as large as 20,000 people, but a more accurate agreed upon number is more like 2,000 to 3,000. Mormons love to inflate numbers, just P.S.
Many people who know about Mormon history have heard about a man named William Law. William was BFFs with Joseph until he wasn't, and then tried to literally burn down his legacy with the Nauvoo Expositor. We'll get into that story later. Fewer people, though, have heard of William's older brother, Wilson Law. What I didn't learn before this episode was that Wilson was elected Brigadier General in the Nauvoo Legion on February 1841, and then Major General on August 1842. Somewhere, Jan Brady is sympathizing with Wilson because although he was a big deal at the time in the Legion, all Mormon history remembers is William. An interesting tidbit about Mr. Wilson Law is that he was elected Major General to replace Babes in Toyland villain John C. Bennett after he was cashiered from the Legion. Of course, the Law brothers would both turn on Mormonism in a big way, and Wilson Law was eventually suspended from the Legion as well, and Charles C. Rich takes his place.
Now, Ben talked about this a little bit already, but as the handful of years rolled on in Nauvoo, let's just say issues with outsiders became extremely tense. People are watching Mormons grow the city like crazy. They see Joseph Smith gobbling up all the power, and now they're marching all the time, too, and showing off their weapons. Interestingly, it seems very likely that a Nauvoo Legion drill is what turned Thomas Sharp on them. He's in town as an invited guest, and he's there, and he sees them marching around and thinks, I don't know about these guys. They might be a little scary. There's a really good, I think it's in Sunstone, article about this, that was the turning point. So maybe tone down your parades, guys.
Marching doesn't impress everybody.
Let's just hope arms were at our sides instead of different positions. And, you know, it's nothing to be concerned about, folks. It's just grown-up dudes playing dress-up. It's all cool. But things come to a head, and I mean, this is really a defining moment in Mormon history. In June of 1844, I mean, you've got Mormon complaints of violence, thievery, counterfeit, corruption, and all of this is making its way to Illinois Governor Thomas Ford.
Mormons had too much power and political influence now in Hancock County. Thomas C. Sharp, as Brian just mentioned, had begun to organize an anti-Mormon political party in 1841, which continuously published pieces, keeping nearby residents up to date on the happenings of Mormons. And again, in South Dakota, it's the same thing. Everyone we met out there knew about this compound, because when you're in a small town and neighborhood, the Mormons come in and they start building compounds and bringing in semi-trucks.
They're hunting lodges. It's okay.
Yeah, you're a little like, what's going on? So his editorials in the Warsaw Signal by Thomas Sharp constantly critiqued Mormon power, Joseph Smith's corruption, land speculation, and the bee-in-his-bonnet military force that was the Nauvoo Legion and all their marching.
And of course, we'll talk about this in greater detail later, but Mormons were dealing with defection, like a lot of it. Like Lindsay said earlier in the interview with Ben, the Nauvoo Legion was focused far more on dissent from inside the ranks than it was protecting the city from outside threats. I mean, this is definitely a holdover from Missouri. This is a theme that we've seen for sure. And one of those threats were those pesky Law brothers, William and Wilson.
Like all other Nauvoo startups, the Law brothers decide to start a printing press known as the Nauvoo Expositor. And this is really reductive, but basically they publish only one issue with their printing press on June 7th, 1844. But one issue is all they needed, because this particular issue was a real doozy. Written by Smith's former close friends and associates, the paper accused Joseph Smith of secret polygamy and so much more.
P.S. If you ever find an original issue of this Nauvoo Expositor, that is a true collectible, because they did not survive, surprisingly.
How many were in circulation?
I would guess they probably printed a lot of them, but given all the craziness that goes on, you can see why not many survived. So it was really fun. For 1 year at Mormon History Association, Signature Books did a really nicely, they retypeset it, but they did a facsimile of that. That was really cool. That's a fun thing. And all this stuff going on, Joseph Smith might have handled this differently, and he could have had a different ending. Let's just say he flips out over this publication. They consult law dictionaries, and then finally they decide the printing press is going to be destroyed. They go in, they burn the place down, they pie the type, they chuck it in the street, and it didn't really help the tensions with outsiders watching all this. Imagine that.
They didn't just burn it down. They burned it down with a flare, if you will.
Yeah. Of all the scenes in Nauvoo, that would have been, because you can see how they have all this leftover trauma from Missouri that they didn't deal with. And then dissent crops back up, and they go crazy here. So it leads to public outrage. Not surprisingly, again, destroying a press in America at this point doesn't go over well. And Joseph Smith and Hiram, as well as other members of the Nauvoo City Council, were charged with inciting a riot, which is fair, because that's exactly what they did. And warrants were then issued for Joseph Smith, which were promptly dismissed in Nauvoo courts. Thank you, Nauvoo City Charter, because the court system, of course, is run by Mormons. And never want to throw baking soda on a fire. Joseph Smith tries some vitamin G instead. Let's just dump gas on there. He declares martial law in Nauvoo and set out a bat signal to the Nauvoo Legion.
Glenn Leonard said, on June 18, 1844, Joseph Smith and several associates from the Nauvoo Legion climbed atop Porter Rockwell's partially built home across from the mansion house. From this makeshift speaker's platform, the prophet addressed the assembled legion for the last time. A number of men who heard him kept notes of the address. Most commonly, they remembered his challenge to them to defend their families and beloved Nauvoo from mob threats. Joseph Smith's words included a quote, "I call upon God and angels to witness that I have unsheathed my sword with firm and unalterable determination that this people shall have their legal rights and shall be protected from mob violence, or my blood shall be spilt upon the ground," end quote.
And you've probably seen, this is one of the more famous paintings from the Nauvoo era, is him up on the platform doing this. So it was memorialized. Joseph Smith invited Governor Ford out to Nauvoo, and the governor didn't just decline, he declined hard. He demanded that the Nauvoo Legion surrender its arms.
Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see.
In the nearby town of Carthage, maybe you've heard of it, non-Mormons were outraged by the burning of the press, and they adopt a resolution critiquing a decision of the Nauvoo Municipal Court dismissing this arrest warrant for Joseph Smith. The resolution charged, quote, "the wicked and abominable Mormon leaders with corruption," and warned them that another extermination order might be in the cards. And anytime you bring up an EO to Mormons, this triggers Mormons really hard, to put it lightly.
And if you want to know more about this decision to destroy the expositor, you can read an article written by none other than Mr. Dallin H. Oakes. Back in the days when he was in academia, yeah, he wrote about legal issues all the time, and this was one of the things they tackled. So now, it's only 4 days after giving this last speech to the Legion, which Smith also stated, quote, "I am willing to sacrifice my life for your preservation," that he and his buddies flee to Iowa, eventually hoping to do the Von Trapp family thing and escape and disappear into the mountains forever. But you know this story. Things get messy. Smith returns to surrender, and he's doing this to hope to prevent mobs from attacking Nauvoo, which works on that part. Not so great for him.
And some say Emma convinced him to return. We talk about all that later when we talk about the martyrdom. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so this is the famous quote that Willard Richards' notorious, you know, terrible handwriting reports Smith saying, quote, "I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am calm as a summer's morning. I have a conscience void of an offense toward God and toward all men. If they take my life, I shall die an innocent man," end quote.
I love telling my kids I'm as calm as a summer's morning.
I like telling my kids I'm like a lamb to the slaughter. It's like making breakfast. I'm going in like a lamb to the slaughter. I'm waking up.
Kids don't appreciate these jokes.
They don't. They don't. Some might say they're traumatized by them.
Things were happening really fast at this point. By June 25th, Governor Ford met with Joseph and Hiram in Carthage to negotiate their voluntary surrender. They are charged with inciting a riot, and later in the day, a charge of treason is slapped onto their rap sheet. Justice of the Peace Robert Smith, who certainly wasn't a cure for Mormons, ordered the Smith brothers be held in Carthage jail without bail until a hearing could be held a few days later. That's a solid 80s joke.
Thank you. Worked it in there just for you. Of course, as most of us know, the hearing never happens and the Smiths don't even make it to June 29th. By the 27th, all was lost and the Smith boys were killed in Carthage jail, where they and some of their friends were being held. And we'll give all the dirty deets about what Mormons call the martyrdom in a later episode.
It's really interesting that idea of martyrs, that has become so entrenched.
Isn't it weird when you're going through papers and you see, you know, Warren Jeffs framed that way? Isn't that kind of a weird trip? You know, knowing what we know about Warren. And again, I call Warren Jeffs the Godwin Law of Mormonism. You know, I remember Robin Jensen might remember this. They were giving a presentation at MHA and Jan Shipps was there, and they were talking about the new Council 50 Minutes and how that's going to affect Mormons. And of course, they were only talking about Mormons being LDS. And I had just gotten back from Short Creek and I raised my hand. I was like, well, what is this going to do to other fundamentalist Mormons? Jan Shipps rolled her eyes so hard at me that it's still rolling like a stone cut without hands. Like it just rolled forever. And I thought this is a valid question because there are thousands of people, thousands and thousands and thousands that still follow this. And yeah, I don't want to, you know, bring Warren Jeffs into every conversation, but it is relevant when you're talking about the persecution narrative. How we see Warren Jeffs and his group is how a lot of people saw Mormons back then.
Recently, in preparation for going to South Dakota, I was reading through some of Warren Jeffs, what he called his private priesthood record. And then also recently, I re-listened to John Turner's Brigham Young biography. And then I've also been knee-deep in fundamentalist records from the 1940s. And if you can go through all of that and not see tons of parallels, then I don't know what to tell you.
And not only that, folks like Warren Jeffs specifically, we're just talking about the FLDS today, he was deliberately trying to reenact and recraft narratives that Joseph Smith did. So if you see parallels...
Yes, it was on a different level. That's fair, but...
Of course. And that's the thing. Like, everyone always wants to talk about child brides or whatever, but there's so much more to the FLDS than child brides. There's so much more to that. And so, yes, you can roll your eyes, Jan Ships, fair, but actually, I think that we need to start talking about Mormonism in a broader perspective and consider the impact of these documents, not just on the LDS community.
Gee, I wonder if we'll do that on this podcast. Man, once we get to fundamentalist history, you people better saddle up for real. All right, so they had their guns confiscated, their titles were stripped, that's one thing. But having their beloved leader murdered in jail, that's an incredibly difficult blow to take. And a lot changed for them after the death of their prophet, but the Nauvoo Legion history would continue on. Let's go back to Glenn Leonard for a minute. Quote, after Joseph Smith's death, the Nauvoo Legion filled the position of Lieutenant General, there's that position, by electing Brigham Young to the premier position in August 1844. He had served previously for a time as an assistant chaplain, an appointment without uniform. The Illinois legislature rescinded the Nauvoo City Charter the following January, and with it, the Nauvoo Legion. However, in territorial Utah, Young once again served as titular head of the militia. Yeah, I said titular. Calm down in the back.
Speaking of titular, Brigham Young, he sucked at this, and I love this Glenn Leonard article because he talks about how, you know, Brigham is portrayed in the Legion, but it's like this slow burn of he never served in the military. He was sort of the guy co-opting the thing, leading the military thing, but never actually doing the military thing.
And they didn't like him as well as they did Joseph. We didn't say that, though.
That's right. Even though Governor Ford had suspended the Legion before Joseph Smith's death, by December of 1844, the Illinois State Legislature met and decided to repeal the entire Nauvoo Charter. Ford said that the charter's privileges had been much abused by Mormons, to put it lightly, but he also had witnessed Mormon zealotry firsthand, and he had asked for caution. He said, let's not scrap this entire document, and instead, let's just kind of amend it. He said, quote, I do not see how 10 or 12,000 people can do well in a city without some chartered privileges. It didn't matter, though. By January 29th, 1845, the charter was repealed with overwhelming support by a vote of 25 to 14 in the Illinois Senate and 75 to 31 in the House.
Sucks for you, Mormons. Stripped of power and protection from Illinois and the federal government, the Mormons now relied solely on a theocratic administrative structure. It was informally called the City of Joseph for a time while it was disincorporated. It's not even Nauvoo anymore. Then there's this two-year period where no one knew who was in charge of the Mormons, and this leads to the succession crisis, which we will definitely talk about. But this is where the secret police idea really comes into play.
So we know that as early as the organization of Zion's March, Joseph Smith had bodyguards and some form of what you could call a secret police. During the Legion's time, several trusted associates were part of that organization, sometimes called Daughters of Zion, Daughter of Zion, or the Danites. By the death of Joseph Smith, Brigham Young issued what we will call an informal security measures, known as the Whistling and Whittling Elders, or the Whittling and Whistling Brigades.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine, give me that old-fashioned morphine, give me that old-fashioned morphine, that's good enough for me. It was good enough for Isabel Eberhard, it was good enough for Isabel Eberhard, it was good enough for Isabel Eberhard. That's good enough for me.
So if you search Whistling and Whittling Brigade on the LDS Church's official website, you'll see several glowing talks about the faith of the young boys who were part of this small brigade. But don't be fooled. They were not always quite so nice and tidy as they might portray.
Yeah, when you dig into the story of this, it was really wild, and I think we might have included this on the podcast already, but they sort of glow about how these young boys were protecting the group, but really it's a bunch of guys that would follow you around whistling and trying to intimidate you throughout the city. And I just got lazy and yoinked this right off of Wikipedia, but this is what they say about the brigade. This is what they say about the brigade from a witness. The process of whittling out an officer was as follows. A great tall man by the name of Hosea Stout was the captain of the Whittling Society, and he had about a dozen assistants. They all had great bowie knives and would get a long piece of pine board and get up close to the officer and pretend to be cutting the pine board, but would cut over it and cut near the officer. In the meantime, small boys would get tin pans, old bells, and all sorts of things to make a noise with and surround the officer. No one would touch or say a word to him, but the noise was drowned out all that he would say. So basically, they would walk around whistling, you know, ominously following you until they drove you out of town.
We're going to try not to do this too much, but when you hear stories about people that go down to Short Creek and the God Squad follows them around, everyone's like, oh, that's so weird and terrible. This doesn't come out of nowhere. I mean, this has clear historical precedent. So, sorry, back down off the soapbox.
Jan Ships is still rolling her eyes.
She is still rolling her eyes. Even though Mormon power was dwindling, Nauvoo was, on the contrast, expanding. By 1845, it was said to have nearly 12,000 citizens. Just for comparison, Chicago had about 15,000 at the time. Nauvoo was a big city, and Mormons were really becoming a thorn in the side of Illinois, and the United States, for that matter. Peace was not really possible any longer, and LDS leaders, including Brigham Young, would negotiate a truce with government officials that would allow for Mormons to slowly but surely leave the territory and head west somewhere.
Ah, head west. We are almost there, Brian. I can feel it. We're almost out of Nauvoo into the valley of the Great Uinta Basin, where we can talk about what I believe is the very most interesting stories in Mormon history, where you and I can finally say this is the right place.
Now, you just hold your horses, young lady, because we're not there yet. We still have some Nauvoo history to go through, including the story of the Nauvoo Legion. As Mormons were leaving the city, by September 1846, angry citizens of about 1,000 people, anti-Mormons, besieged the city of Nauvoo, and a skirmish leads to about 3 Mormons being killed and wounded on both sides, definitely. Daniel H. Wells, who will become a Mormon eventually, surrounds to the mob and arranges to get Mormons out quicker. Mormons pour into Iowa, encroaching on protected Indian land.
The Nauvoo Temple, which Mormons were so proud of, was destroyed by arsonists on November 19th, 1848.
And then the tornado gets it, and then the Icarians come, and they reuse the stone, and yeah.
Then the Catholics storm into Nauvoo, and all is lost.
Yeah, Nauvoo is such an interesting place, even after the Mormons leave, so. What we know about Mormons, though, is you can take them out of Illinois, but you can't take the militia out of them. I don't know, it's not very catchy. The Nauvoo Legion would continue, although no longer under federal protection, in different forms throughout Mormon history. In the Utah Territory, the organization and leaders would morph into individual militias that would protect settlements all over the American West. But you have to wait until we're done with Nauvoo to hear where and how these militias ended up.
At the very least, we hope you'll see the complexity here about the Legion and the need for protection, as well as the fear this caused others and outsiders. When we opened at the top of the episode, we talked about the militia from Mormon fundamentalist sect known as the AUB. If I had been there watching my neighbors hide dynamite in mountains and stockpile weapons while practicing polygamy and other things I don't agree with, I'd be concerned. And it was no different for folks in Illinois. The AUB had experienced having their own prophet murdered before in the 1970s. They were suspicious of a lot of things. Same thing with the folks in Illinois who saw their prophet murdered as well.
So this pattern set by the Nauvoo Legion carries over to most of American militias today. I think people would be surprised to realize how many of modern-day militias actually have roots in Mormonism. The 3% movement, constitutionalists, independent groups, you name it. There are traces and hints of Mormonism that go throughout them. These modern militias are still inspired by the events of Illinois in the 1840s and the Nauvoo Legion. All right, friends, Books of Mormon's time. Surprisingly, as important as I think the Nauvoo Legion is, there's really only one book on the topic. It's called The Nauvoo Legion in Illinois, A History of the Mormon Militia, 1841 to 1846. So it's done by Richard Bennett, who we talked about in the Temple episodes, Susan Easton Black, who I know is a little triggering for people, but, you know, read the book first, and then BYU professor also Donald Cannon. And it was published by University of Oklahoma Press, so it's you know, a reputable book, and it is such a fascinating period of Mormon history. So if you want to learn more about this, that's a great place to start.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.